Thank you very much. I'd like to first thank the organizers for organizing this interesting workshop. There's not enough of these on interactions between mathematics and medicine. So I'll be talking about the control of eye movements during reading. And this is something I got into about 2-3 years ago. The consequence of my interaction with these people over in Berlin, at the University of Potsdam. Ralph Engbert, who's a physicist like me, and Reinhold Kliegel, who's a psychologist. And they both work in the psychology department now, cooking up quantitative analysis for various cognitive skills. And so I'm going to be talking basically about three things. I'm going to be describing eye movements during reading and scene perception, and as an introduction to this topic, which I'm sure not everyone here knows about. And I'll talk about visual attention during reading. So there's a strong contrast here between eye movements and attention, which are the two main ingredients for reading. And finally, I'll talk about how do we go ahead to model eye movements in these systems. So eye movements during reading and perception, eye movements can actually be monitored, and these days very accurately. So for example, when you look at a face, this is what your eyes are going to do. You can just scan the scene, and you have a representation there. How much time you spend is proportional to the level of darkness on the face. So you see, you spend a lot of time around the eyes and the mouth, nose region. So during reading, of course, we're looking at something very specific. Reading can be used as a probe into various cognitive skills, and it's uniquely placed in brain research because it's the most widely practiced skill that humans specifically learn. And it offers an opportunity for research on the brain representation of cognitive skills. There's a wide range of individual differences, so the question arises, what's the origin of this intersubject variability or even variability within one subject? And it raises issues, for example, on whether there exists a reading center or whether there are many modules that participate in reading, which is the currently favored view, I believe, in this area. So reading center versus modularity. And another set of arguments that come up in this literature is whether there's high-level versus low-level control for this process. So ocular motor-dominated dumb processes to move your eyes on words versus really high-level syntactic lexical processes to understand what you're reading. And of course, what's interesting to me as well, having come from dynamical diseases background, is that there's a variety of disorders, such as dyslexia and all the types of dyslexia, and these can provide insights if you analyze the movements of eyes from patients with these diseases. That can provide insights into the basic functioning of this highly complex brain, these brain areas. So the important thing first is to study saccadic eye movements. They are very frequent, 2 or 3 saccades per second. These are short ballistic motions of your eye. So while your eye is in motion, you're actually blind. Okay, so you just jump from one place to another. While you're in motion for about 40 milliseconds, you don't see anything. But your brain keeps doing stuff, keeps processing the lexical content of the words you're looking at. And the saccades determine what you see. They move objects into the fovea, the high acuity region of your visual field. So what we're interested in is what can be learned from movements of the eyes about cognition. So eye movements in reading come in a variety of formats, as I'll show in the next slide. A long time ago, I took up a book on speed reading, and it taught me how to grab sentences one at a time and really calculate your landing positions and grouping sentences together so you can increase your speed and read as fast as Balzac or John F. Kennedy and all these incredibly fast readers. So when I landed on this subject and I was told that my eye actually lands on almost every word, I didn't believe it until I saw the data in Germany. They showed me that, yes, you do spend time on every word practically. You just don't realize it. So typical fixation duration, 200 to 250 milliseconds per word. And so fixation is a bit of a misnomer. And there's microsaccades, a bit like the analogy that John's talked previously. There's little movements on a word and then movements between words. Okay. And so there's some ballistic, like drift motion and diffusive motion around that. And reading is a bit like a slideshow. You're looking at words one at a time. And the saccades, as I said, are rapid, and it takes 150 milliseconds to program one of these saccades. During that time, the first two-thirds of it, you can actually cancel that program and reprogram another one. So it's a very intricate feature of saccades. Now, you can measure the time you spend on words. This is data. Fixation duration in milliseconds, that's a function of word frequency class. So what you do is you take the standard corpus of sentences, a million words in English, and classify the frequency of each word. And you come up with these frequency classes, and this is the way people do it in this area, divided into five word frequency classes. And what you see is for very frequent words, you spend less time. And for more difficult words that don't show up as often, you spend less time. There's a nice linear relationship between the two. And also you skip words, so you don't actually land on all words. Like if I complain about something, it's sure the word about is going to come after complain. So you actually skip the word about. Okay, so I'll show you examples of that later. And the easier words are skipped more often. Makes sense, right? So this is the kind of data that's constraining our model. And we're talking about something that's really high level in the brain, like lexical access, semantics, this understanding what a word is. And this has been quantified in the following way, that this lexical access is a linear function of the log of the word frequency. So basically, you have this relationship between the log frequency of the word and the fixation duration, which is going to be proportional to this lexical access variable I. Okay. So another thing you need to know about the reading system is that the center has a very high resolution, but outside you have less, so the first 2 degrees have high resolution. But here, although you have less resolution, you can still read the words. Okay? And this was investigated by Helmholtz about over 120 years ago. And what he realized is that you can actually look at one point and then you can try and shift your attention to another area. So while your eyes are going to be measured as looking at this point, your attention is actually somewhere else. And he was able to calculate certain features of this. And this is called shift of attention, covert shift attention. Okay, because you can't actually measure it, although this would be fun to do, be able to measure where is one person's attention, not so much where their eyes are, right? So you can make a million with that. So the random walk over words is the picture we have here when you're reading. So you have a stream of words, and I'm going to look at this process with my colleagues as basically some dynamical system, which is your reading system in your brain, and it's being fed these words. And these words come in different frequency classes, and they have a certain correlation structure to them, of course, for words to make sentences that make sense to us. So you can go from word n minus 1 to word n plus 1, so that's a skipping motion, or you have the straightforward movement along the words, and you can have a refixation. Your eyes can just kind of stay on one word and then jiggle around and come back to that word right away. That's a refixation, or you can regress. You go back. Two-thirds of sentences actually have regressions, where at some point your eyes go quickly back. Now, there's a main class of models that has addressed this kind of data, and they're called sequential attention shift models. We'll say something about them in a minute. But it turns out that most of these models can deal with just a simple forward motion and refixations if you really put in lots of control loops, but doesn't deal with regressions, which is two-thirds of the sentences have them. So here's the idea of sequential attention shift. So you're looking at a one word, the fixated word, and then you program a saccade to move your eye to the next word. However, while you're looking here, you start processing this word here. And if this is easy, then you're going to cancel this program and move on to the next word. So you access this word lexically with your covert attention, and then if you process it, finish processing it in time, you cancel that program, and then you program a saccade to the next word. But you have to have the right timing to do that, because there's only 100 milliseconds where you can cancel that saccade. Now, this is the class of models that have been fairly good at describing the quantitative features of this kind of data. This is from Reichel et al., a group in, near Boston. And to model refixations, let's say, in this in their modeling, you require up to 14 internal states and these fairly complicated diagrams to figure out where to go as your attention sequentially shifts from one place to another. Okay. Now, this raises the question that, do we really want to go that route, have a very complex computational model, or should we try and simplify things and maybe come up with another strategy and explain complex movement patterns, regressions, and refixations, and normal movement in a model of eye movement control, as opposed to having these like 14 internal states. So what we're looking for is a common mechanism for all these things, saccades, refixations, regressions. And one important ingredient, and this is based on recent literature, is that you can actually separate where and when, or actually you can try it in a model and see the predictive value of this, and it turns out it's actually very good. You can separate where from when in your programming of saccades. That means when you've decided when to saccade, you know yet where you're going to saccade. In most models, you need to have that information. You can't program a saccade without knowing where. But there's recent information in the literature that tells you that actually these processes can be decoupled. You don't need to know where you're going before you program it. So we're looking at a common mechanism for these, and our inspiration came a lot from this theory called dynamical field theory, which I'll show you a slide about this a bit later, but basically think of the words as being these objects that are competing for your attention out there, and the one that has the strongest value you'll go and look at. So it's like this word field, and they vary dynamically, and you go towards one or the other. So what we've come up with is a model that's published in Vision Research last year for saccade generation, and the saccades are moving along, but they're inhibited by foveal targets. If the targets are too complicated, you slow down, basically, until you finish processing them. And we separate this where and when in the saccade process. So the other important ingredient is distributing your attention. So instead of having sequential attention shifts, which leads to these complicated diagrams with 14 internal states, let's just assume your attention is spread out over a few words in parallel. So for example, this is where your eyes are looking now. That has the highest processing rate because you have the highest acuity. Yet, the word next to it is processed at a slower rate, but it's processed nevertheless. So you can make this assumption of a processing window, parallel attentional window. And it's a bit skewed to the right, which is true for languages that go from left to right. And some people can read both languages that go left to right and right to left, and they switch this function around when they change from English to Arabic, for example. So this is another modeling assumption. And we assume that all the words are like state variables. You're reading a sentence. The words come in, and each word takes on like a state. So they're like dynamical systems whose dimension is increasing in time. As you feed in more words, each of these words becomes a dynamical variable. And what you need to do for each of these words is, okay, you haven't seen the word yet, and when you start seeing the word, some activity builds up. And this is the first part where you start recognizing features of the word, such as its frequency, its length, so on. And then you start accessing it lexically, what it means in this context. And when you're done that, the word is done. Okay, so this is the time course we ascribe to each word coming in. And, of course, how fast you process depends on where your eyes are. So this depends on what we call the eccentricity. So let's say K is your fixation point. K is the position at time T of your eyes. But each word has an eccentricity with respect to this position. So the position, so this word over here, for example, has an eccentricity of 2 and is processed slower. So all these words are being processed in parallel, and you can ascribe, let's say, a neural field to them, where you've seen word 1, word 2, word 3, word 4, and they're in different states of processing. So this is a neural field idea. And each word, the activity of each word, is simply in a pre-processing stage, which is going up, or a lexical access stage, which is going back down. And each of these processing rates, of course, is a function of the eccentricity. Where are you? Where are your eyes? Okay. Now, all these words are going to be coupled together because the eccentricity depends on the eye position, and now you're going to choose eye positions. So I'll come to that in a second. So basically, each word is going to go up and down. Where does it go up to? That depends on the level of difficulty of this word. If it's a very difficult word, it takes a while to build up, recognize it, and then understand it. So this level LN is a function of two things. One is the one I talked about earlier, the lexical access, which depends on the word frequency, and this is a logarithmic function of the word frequency, or linear, the function of linear log function. But there's another component, which is the predictability. Lots of words are predictable, and you can measure that just from doing statistics on text. So this predictability is going to influence the height of this function. The word is very predictable, then you're going to go up to a very small place and come right back down. So you'll process it quickly. But if it's not very predictable, then you go up to whatever is defined by the word frequency for this word. Okay, so now comes the coupling of all these words to the target selection. So, as I said before, we're going to separate location, like when you saccade to where you saccade. And the programming of saccades requires, in this case, a random timing. So it's quite reasonable to assume, based on psychophysical data, that there's actually a random time between the saccades. It's not, you're not just ticking away like a clock on the words, but there's some distribution of times between your saccading forward. So the time for a saccade is like some random time you pick from a gamma distribution in this case. And the mean and the standard deviation are a factor of 3. This is psychophysical data. Plus another term which is going to extend this time. So you're going to go have some dumb default moving forward on the words, but then you'll be slowed down. So you'll have an additional time, which depends on, in the simplest case, it would just depend on the activity, let's say the activity level. If that word is hard, it's going to slow you down. You'll have a longer time between saccades. And the final important thing is, where are you going to go? Well, it's this neural field idea, the one that's the most salient, it's the most unprocessed, the highest value of A. That has a high probability of being selected. So you make the transition probability from current position to a new position based on the relative probability of these activities. So this is a normalization factor. And you can't forward ahead, but anyways, the ones ahead aren't predicted, aren't even started yet. So you can predict, you can saccade to anything from refixation to the next word or to two words ahead or somewhere in the back where you've been already. So this targeting is what couples all these dynamical variables together, because it keeps shifting the position of the eyes, changes all the eccentricities, changes all the processing rates of the words. Okay? So, in a diagrammatic format, this is what happens. You have time flowing this way, and you have activity variables for each word, and you have your position of your eyes. Those are the dynamical variables. And you can think of these as being set in advance, the activities of the words, or you can think of the dimension of the system going up as you keep feeding words into the machine. So there's a labile program to program a saccade. That's about 100 milliseconds. And then you have a non-labile program, which means past this point, there's a point of no return. You can't cancel that program. So then there's a last part, it's called the non-labile program, 50 milliseconds. Then there's a target selection, and what we do is we set the target selection to some fraction of this time here of the labile program. And that's reasonable given some psychophysical data that we were able to dig up. So you select the target somewhere during this time. But you don't need to know exactly where you're going yet when you decide when you're going and vice versa. And then you execute the saccade during which you're blind. Takes 20 to 40 milliseconds to do the saccade. Okay? So, this is a kind of data you get out of this model. The model was fitted using some data that we had where we can constrain the mean time between words. And I'll just say that here without you looking at this thing for a second. The data was, the parameters of these models were fitted, okay, by data that we had. For example, mean times between saccades and so on. You put a few basic ingredients. And then we guessed at some of the others, some simple fitting, and we got some basic fits, as I'll show you. We've also used a more fancy method using a genetic algorithm to kind of shuffle all kinds of data sets and just find the optimal one, and this produced very similar results. So that's on the fitting procedure. I won't go into more detail on that, but this is a representation of the movement of the eyes across this sentence. The child had a nightmare about being chased by hornets and wasps. It's a bit of a complicated, convoluted sentence. So your eyes start here. This is time, and this is the activity of each word in different colors. So you have the first word, the, blue, goes up, right, up and down quickly. The black bars here are where your eyes are. Okay, so you see that while your eyes are here on the, you start processing this word and you start processing this word because of your shift of covert attention or the parallel processing of words. Now, so then you go to the next word. Here you jump up. You keep going. And you see you jumped up here because by the time you're at this point about to do a saccade, these two words have been processed already. You had a good idea that it's had a, you know, the child had a, okay? So you just skip straight to here. And then you move up, then you move back down and back up again. This is a regression. Okay? So this is the kind of activity you have in this model. Where did it regress to? Well, you see at that point here, the black bar, which I can't point to exactly up there, this was still a salient feature, this yellow line here. This word hadn't been quite processed yet. It became a very high probability target, so your eyes go back to it here. But it's not rigid. It's not deterministic. There's some stochasticity involved. It's a probabilistic target function. Okay, so what you can do is, as I said, fit the data from the model and, fit the parameters of the model in order to try and reproduce the data. So what we have here, the dashed lines are the experimental values. In this case, fixation durations versus word frequency class. So again, you see the sloping line. High frequency words are, you spend less time on them, basically. But there's three different curves here, depending whether it's the first time you see the word, whether it's the total time you see the word, or whether you see that word only once. So all this data has been gathered, and you can try and reproduce it, and you can see what your model does. And you can fit the data very well with solid lines here. Okay? And another thing you can look at is the probability of skipping as a function of frequency class. So if you remember in the original data, higher frequency words are skipped more often. So this is the data in dashed line, and this is what the model reproduces. And then you can look at other statistics as well, which are fitted by the model. Okay, so this is our approach to modeling eye movements during reading. It's based on new features in contrast to sequential attention shift models. You have fixation durations and word skipping, which, of course, is already in these models. But we can also do refixations and regressions, so analyze whole complex patterns. We don't have to throw out two-thirds of the data set now. We can analyze the whole variability of the reading process. Okay. So the ingredients that we have in our model are attentional window, which is, so you have distributed attention over a few words. Highest processing speed for central words right in your fovea. So this is a distributed processing approach. And we separate saccade timing from target selection. And this provides a common mechanism for forward saccades and refixations and regressions. Okay. Now, of course, this works as a computational model, a computational neuroscience model. But to me, there's still something missing. I would like to be able to predict, for example, how long does it take to read the sentence? Can I predict these functions theoretically? What does the skipping probability look like as a function of so on and so forth? I can also tinker with the model and produce effects that I think are related to dyslexia, and try and compare that with data. That data is being collected this summer, actually, over in Germany. So that will be interesting to compare. So you lesion the model on the computer and you just see what happens. But you still would like to gain some theoretical insights from this computational approach. And in my experience in doing stochastic dynamical systems, this is somewhat of a challenging problem because I don't really know how to deal with systems that expand your dimension as a function of time. You have this complex distributed attention. You have this probabilistic target function. So you need to make some simplification somewhere to start. And that's where we're at now. We don't have a nice big equation, Fokker-Planck equation, to give us the evolution of your probability on words and so on, and what's your mean reading velocity. But that's where we're heading. And I'm going to give you a few examples of analysis that we're doing to go in that direction. Okay, so one thing we can do is this. We can look at this reading process as a random walk over words, as I said earlier. So, for example, here's a sentence. None of the students wanted to have an exam after spring break. We have a similar representation to what we had on the computer before with the colors, except there's no colors. And what is plotted here is an average over many, many realizations of the model. So by realization, I mean this is a stochastic model. You run it once with a set of random numbers. You run it again with other random numbers, and you average. And what you can plot is where you are on average at a given time along the sentence. So this is the center curve here, plus or minus the standard deviation. So I'm really looking at this as a random walk and basically as a deviation from standard random walks, either a persistent random walk or other kinds of random walks. Or what exactly is this thing? That's what I'm trying to figure out. And what you can plot also, so this is the basically the evolution of the random walk with time. And what I have at each time here is kind of a little function plotted sideways. This is the actual probability density you have on each word. So this time, the density is fairly constrained. But as time goes, you see that it starts to get a big tail here at lower words. You would expect that, but have some probability here. This is the activity variables that I'm plotting. So this means, for example, at this time here, word number 3 was almost probability 0, but word number 4, at this point, you look at the deviation this way, it has a certain probability. Okay, so it's a likely target. Or it's a possible target. And what you see is as you go along, the density spreads out and starts acquiring new features, tails, bumps, two modes, and so on. And what I plotted in the middle here is simply the mean of that density and its standard deviation. But I wanted to plot the whole density to really see, you know, if you don't have a symmetric distribution, standard deviations don't tell you that much. So you need to go a bit further. So this is one thing you can look at. And what you can also look at is what happens when you turn off the predictability of the words. And it turns out the predictability of the words is a big ingredient here. It's what imposes the correlation structure in your sentence. So I can overlay here the correlation, okay, the effect of the correlation. So what you have here are the same three curves, but now in many average realizations of the model without predictability. So what this affects is that your activity variables for each word go up to a certain level, but now that level is higher for each word because each word is less predictable. So your dynamical variables have to go higher before coming back down. So what you notice is something that you would guess, right? All the curves are shifted down. It takes you longer. So for a given time, you're not as far along the sentence as before. You notice that the variance has increased a bit as well. So that's a bit strange. So by reducing the predictability, you're increasing the variance. So not too clear what's happening here. But there's definitely an effect of slowing down the reading process. And another thing you can look at is the correlation between different aspects of these dynamics. So, for example, this is the actual trajectory a random walk normally has like the variance of your the standard deviation increases a square root of time. So the standard deviation here kind of has a bump and a few features, and the velocity has a bump along with the error. So you kind of move along fast when you have when there's a lot of error. So when there's a big variance in the trajectory, let me show you here back on this previous plot. So here the variance is high. The variance is high right here, and your velocity is high. But what you find is also the predictability is high at that point. So the predictability is high. So somehow when you insert predictability or correlation, predictable correlation in the sentence, you induce these kind of deviations from standard motion forward. If things become very predictable, then you're likely to kind of start skipping or refixating or maybe have a regression. These accidents show up. Deviations from a standard progression forward. So the predictability starts creating some more randomness in the problem. So that's one direction we're heading. And this is work in progress. And another work in progress, which I'll just say a word about here, is you can also study the complexity of these sentences. These are all complex eye movements, and we can do some kind of analysis of what's the distribution of patterns that you can generate. So for example, and this is a popular area of research, of course, in all nonlinear dynamics, to do symbolic dynamics. You throw away the intricate details of the trajectories, and you just keep certain features. So for example, let's forget about where you are exactly in time. Let's just look at what you did to get across this sentence. And write a zero whenever you skip the word, one if you just did a single fixation, two if you did a refixation, and three if you did a regression. So then what you can do is you can look at your actual sequences. And this is what we have here. So we try a sentence, the angry man called a senator to complain about the new tax law. And these are all the different patterns that you have to read this sentence. So for example, you did 1, 1, 3, 1 with a certain probability here. Okay? Actually, what we're gonna do is we're gonna study how many patterns you can get as a function of certain parameters in your model. So for example, this is the mean time between your saccades. This is a measure of reading speed. Are you going to read this text slowly, which is down here, slowly, which is up there, or quickly, which is down here? So the reading speed of the subject. And beta is a measure of the reader's vocabulary. It's related to the slope of that linear logarithmic function. So high vocabulary and reading speed. And what you can do for each combination of these parameters, you can see which sentence do you get. So you get this big yellow region here, and this yellow region is this pattern. And for each combination of the parameters, you get only one sequence. And this should strike you as odd because there's noise in the model, and what I did is I turned it off. I turned all noise sources off. The starting point. And what you see is now, just as you change parameters a bit, you jump into these other regions with other sentences, with other patterns of walking over the words. But this is totally nonlinear deterministic feature of the model, because there's no noise. So you see that if these parameters are actually distributions instead of deterministic parameters, you're going to get a mixture of these different regions. And what you can have is if the parameters are a bit different from one subject to another, you can have a very different pattern going through. And one thing that's also interesting is you see that it can vary a lot in certain places, but in other places here, it's the same across all words, 1, 0. Okay, no matter where you are in this parameter space, you always do complain about in the same way. But other areas are more fickle, and it varies. The question to you?
Yeah.
This is just to tell you which sentences, which patterns go where on this plot. So the red, let's say the red there is somewhere here. So if you have parameters in this region, parameters in this region, you always get this pattern. You go and read off the pattern. And that tells you, you go single, single, skip, single, regression, so on. And then you go to another place and you say, ah, if my parameters are this in my model or in my subject, I get this pattern. But of course, what we get is a whole variety of them, because if you turn the noise on, then you start doing this. And what we're doing now is we're calculating various quantities, entropy measures, scaling laws, which I won't show you, time is up, but you can calculate scaling laws or scaling laws like in self-organized criticality that are showing up in this area. Not surprising. Somehow, maybe the system is poised at some stability boundary to really optimally benefit from noise, like in John's talk. So this is, let's say, the front wave that we're riding to get into understanding these cognitive skills and what is the neural basis. Okay, so thanks for your attention.